Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are tackling, well, a really notorious book. It's Niccolo Machiavelli's The Prince, a text that honestly people have argued about for, what, 500 years?
Absolutely. It's been loved, hated, definitely misunderstood. But if you want to understand how power really works behind the scenes, this is kind of the essential, maybe uncomfortable starting point.
Right. And maybe we should say up front, this deep dive is useful because The Prince isn't about moral philosophy in the way we usually think about it. It's more like a cold, hard manual for political survival.
Exactly. It gets right down to this fundamental, maybe unsettling question. How does a leader actually get power, keep power, and maybe even expand it, especially when the world is, you know, unpredictable and often pretty hostile?
And I think what keeps it so relevant, so controversial even now, is how it just blows up the traditional idea that, you know, being morally good automatically makes you an effective leader.
It forces you to look at result stability, security for the state versus conventional ideas of virtue. It's quite a stark assessment of, well, political reality. A bit brutal, maybe.
Definitely brutal. But you have to understand the man behind it to really get the book's cynicism, maybe.
For sure. Niccolo Machiavelli, born 1469, died 1527. He wasn't some academic sitting in an ivory tower. This guy was a high-ranking civil servant in the Florentine Republic, second chancellor for 14 years.
So he was in it. He wasn't just observing from afar. He was dealing with the absolute chaos of Renaissance Italy. You know, constant warfare, shifting alliances, regimes rising and falling.
Right, and he saw firsthand the tactics of ruthless figures. People like Cesare Borgia, who becomes a major example in the book. That direct experience, that closeness to the raw mechanics of power, gives his writing this grounded, almost clinical feel.
It's wisdom earned the hard way, you could say. Not from books, but from the political battlefield itself.
And it came at a real personal cost. When the Medici family came back to power in Florence, 1512, Machiavelli was out instantly.
Yeah, he was accused of conspiracy, wasn't he? Thrown in prison, even tortured.
He was. And it was only after all that, during his exile to his small farm around 1513, that he actually wrote The Prince.
Which is kind of ironic, isn't it? He wrote this guide to power when he was powerless.
Exactly. And he dedicated it to the new Medici ruler, Lorenzo, basically as a job application. Like, look what I know. Look how useful I can be. It wasn't abstract philosophy. It was a practical handbook built on like pure observation of what works and what fails in the real world.
Okay, so let's dig into the book itself. What is it, structurally?
Well, The Prince is short. It's direct. It's really a political treatise, but framed as a practical guide, specifically for what Machiavelli calls a new prince.
Meaning someone who didn't just inherit the throne, right? Someone who got power through maybe conquest or their own skill, their own virtue.
Precisely. And this is where it breaks sharply from tradition. Back then, you had this genre of books, Mirrors for Princes, basically telling rulers how to be good, pious, just merciful.
And Machiavelli just throws that out the window.
Completely. He says, look, if you try to be perfectly good all the time in the world as it is, you'll be crushed by people who aren't good. It's political suicide.
So that's the core argument then. Politics is its own game with its own rules, separate from, say, personal ethics.
You got it. The number one job of the prince, the ruler, is the security and stability of the state. Full stop. And if achieving that means doing things that seem, well, bad, cruelty, deception, then the prince must learn how not to be good. Necessity dictates action.
The end justifies the means, essentially, even though he never quite says those exact words.
That's the implication everyone takes, yeah.
Yeah.
The success, the survival of the state is the ultimate measure. So the book then breaks down how to do this. It looks at different kinds of states, talks military strategy, and then dives deep into the really controversial stuff, the mindset, the moral flexibility a ruler needs.
Okay, let's walk through some of that. He starts with types of states, right? Principalities.
Yep. He focuses on principalities, basically states ruled by one person, a prince. And he says, look, hereditary ones where power is passed down, those are pretty easy to hold on to. People are used to the ruling family.
But the new ones, or mixed ones, where you've maybe added territory, those are the real challenge.
Huge challenge. Because you've inevitably upset the people you conquered, and you probably can't keep all the promises you made to the allies who helped you get there. It's a political minefield.
So what's his advice for dealing with that? keeping hold of newly conquered places.
Well, some of it sounds pretty chilling today. He suggests things like establishing small, efficient colonies easier to manage than a large occupying army. Crucially, eliminate the previous ruling family completely. No loose ends.
Ruthless.
Totally. But also, somewhat surprisingly, he advises not messing too much with local laws and taxes, at least initially. Don't give people unnecessary reasons to resent you right away.
And he uses examples of who got it wrong.
Oh, yeah. He points to King Louis XII of France's failures in Italy. Louis made a bunch of classic mistakes. He got rid of weaker powers who could have been allies. He brought in a stronger foreign power, Spain. He didn't live there himself, and he changed the local systems. Basically a masterclass in how not to do it.
The lesson seems to be, act decisively, be ruthless up front to secure control, but then try to maintain stability by not disrupting daily life too much.
Exactly. Swift, surgical, then stabilize. Which leads naturally to the next big topic, the military.
Right, because you can't hold on to power without force.
Machiavelli is absolutely clear on this. He says the foundation of any state is good laws and good arms. But then he immediately says you can't really have good laws without good arms to back them up. Force underpins everything.
And he had strong opinions about what kind of arms, didn't he? Particularly about mercenaries.
Oh, he despised them. Calls them useless and dangerous.
Why useless?
Because their only motivation is money. They aren't loyal to the prince or the state. They fight for the highest bidder. They're undisciplined, unreliable in battle, and might even turn on you if someone offers them more.
And dangerous for the same reasons, I guess.
Precisely. He saw Italy's constant weakness and vulnerability as partly caused by its reliance on these mercenary captains, the condottieri. They had no real stake in the outcome beyond their pay.
So what's the alternative? What must a prince do?
Rely on your own people. Build an army from your own subjects, citizens who have a real investment in defending their homes and their state. Loyalty is key.
And it's not just about having the army, it's about the prince's personal involvement.
Absolutely essential. The prince's main job, his primary thought, even in peacetime, must be the art of war. Studying strategy, knowing the terrain, learning from history's military campaigns. You have to be prepared before the crisis hits.
Okay, so you've secured the state, you've got your loyal army. Now, how does the prince behave? This is where it gets really dicey, morally speaking.
This is the core, yeah. The break from tradition. He says, point blank, a prince who tries always to be morally good will be destroyed. Because most people aren't always good. So survival means learning how not to be good when you have to be.
Let's take an example he uses. Generosity versus being spingy.
Yeah.
Parsimonious.
Right. Convention says, be generous, win goodwill. Machiavelli says, nope, bad idea.
Why?
Because large-scale generosity costs a fortune. It depletes the treasury. And then what happens? You either have to stop being generous, which makes you look fickle, or you have to raise taxes heavily.
And nobody likes higher taxes.
Exactly. Heavy taxes lead to hatred, which is politically fatal. So he argues it's actually safer to get a reputation for being a bit miserly parsimonious. It saves money, avoids excessive taxation, and ultimately breeds less resentment than failed generosity.
It's completely counterintuitive to our usual ideas of good leadership.
Totally. And the same logic applies to cruelty versus mercy, or clemency.
You can't always be merciful.
You must be willing to be cruel, he argues, but strategically. Use cruelty decisively, efficiently, well-used cruelty, he calls it, to establish order or make an example, and then ideally, stop. Don't let it become ongoing or gratuitous.
And he uses that Cesare Borgia example again here, right? The one with Ramiro de Orco?
Yes, the classic, almost terrifying example. Borgia needed to pacify the unruly Romagna region. He appointed this guy, Ramiro de Orco, known for being harsh, gave him full powers. De Orco cracks down brutally but successfully establishes order.
Okay, mission accomplished. But then?
Then, once the region is quiet and people are starting to resent de Orco's methods, Borgia has him arrested, tried, and publicly executed in a really gruesome way, cut in half in the town square.
Wow. So why?
Pure political theater. By executing his own harsh enforcer, Borgia achieved two things. He kept the benefits of the now pacified region, and he deflected all the hatred for the necessary cruelty onto De Orco. He made himself look just and responsive to the people's feelings, even though he ordered the crackdown in the first place.
That's incredibly cynical. But you can see the cold logic.
It's the definition of calculated political maneuvering, which brings us right to maybe the most famous question he poses.
Loved or feared?
Loved or feared? If you can't be both, which should a prince prefer?
And his answer?
Fear. He argues it's much safer to be feared than loved.
Safer.
Because love, he says, is based on obligation, on gratitude. And human beings are fundamentally fickle and self-interested. They'll break that bond of love the moment it suits them.
But fear.
Fear is based on the dread of punishment. And that dread, that fear of consequences, it never really goes away. It's a much more reliable motivator, politically speaking.
Okay, but there's a limit, right? He doesn't just say, be terrifying.
Crucial distinction. You must be feared, yes, but you absolutely must avoid being hated.
And what's the fast track to being hated?
Taking people's property and interfering with their women, those are the two big no-nos. Seizing property especially creates deep, lasting resentment that people don't forget. Political cruelty might be seen as necessary for the state, but messing with personal property and family, that makes it personal and generates real hatred.
So navigate this tightrope, feared but not hated, how? What skills does the prince need?
This is where his famous metaphor comes in. The prince must be both a fox and a lion.
Okay, break that down. The lion?
The lion represents strength, force, the ability to scare off the wolves, the enemies. It's the necessary military power, the projection of dominance that keeps rivals in check.
And the fox?
The fox is about cunning, intelligence, recognizing traps, understanding deception, knowing how to navigate the complex webs of politics without getting caught. You need to be clever enough to see the snares and strong enough to fight when necessary.
So it's about adaptability, knowing which role to play when.
Exactly. Raw power alone isn't enough, and neither is pure cleverness. You need both. And this leads to the idea of appearance versus reality.
The prince needs to be a good actor, essentially.
Be a master actor. He must appear to have all the conventional virtues, mercy, faith, integrity, humanity, religion, even if, behind the scenes, necessity forces him to act against them.
Because perception is reality in politics.
Pretty much. Machiavelli puts it bluntly. Everyone sees what you appear to be. Few experience what you really are. As long as the state is successful and stable, most people will judge based on the appearance and the outcome, not the hidden actions.
Okay, so these ideas, these methods, they obviously caused a huge stir. They really laid the groundwork for thinking about politics in a new way. What are the major themes we should pull out?
I think the first and maybe most fundamental is political realism versus idealism. Machiavelli insisted on looking at the verità effettuale, the actual truth of things, how politics really operates, not how we wish it would operate.
Which requires a pretty dim view of human nature, doesn't it?
It does. He sees people as generally self-interested, ungrateful, easily deceived. You have to base your political strategy on that reality, not on some idealized vision of citizens.
Okay, theme one, realism. What's next?
Theme two is the interplay of virtue and fortuna. Fortuna is fortune, luck, chance, the unpredictable events that shape our world. Machiavelli reckons it controls maybe half of our affairs.
Like a raging river, he says somewhere.
Exactly. But the other half is controlled by virtue. And this is key. Virtue for Machiavelli isn't moral virtue. It's skill, ability, strength, decisiveness, and crucially, adaptability.
So you can't control the flood of fortune, but you can use your virtue to build dams and channels.
That's the metaphor, yeah. Prepare, adapt, use your skills to mitigate the damage from bad luck, and seize opportunities when good luck strikes. Don't just be passive.
Got it. Realism, virtue, fortuna, theme three.
This is the really radical one, the autonomy of political action. Basically, politics operates by its own rules, separate from private morality. An action that's wrong for an individual might be necessary, even good for a ruler, if it preserves the state.
So the highest moral duty for the prince is the health and security of the state itself.
That's his argument. Lying, breaking a treaty, even calculated cruelty, if it serves the greater good of keeping the state stable and secure, it becomes politically justifiable, even necessary.
It's easy to see why that was, and still is, so controversial.
Absolutely. But there's a fourth theme, often overlooked, especially when people just focus on the cynicism, and that's national unity and liberation.
Right. The end of the book changes tone quite a bit.
Dramatically. The final chapter is this passionate, patriotic plea for a strong leader, a new prince, using the methods he's described to finally unite Italy and kick out the foreign powers dominating it, the barbarians.
So all the cold, hard advice was ultimately aimed at achieving this larger, quite noble, nationalistic goal.
That seems to be his ultimate motivation. The ruthless pragmatism was a tool intended for a specific patriotic purpose, a strong, unified, independent Italy.
It definitely adds another layer to just calling him Machiavellian in the negative sense.
Okay, the book is also famous for its quotes, or at least the ideas people quote.
Oh, definitely. Packed with the memorable lines or lines that capture a core idea. What's the big one everyone knows?
Probably. It is better to be feared than loved, if one of the two has to be wanting. We touched on it. Fear, based on punishment, is constant. Love is fickle. It's pure political calculation.
And the fox and lion metaphor, that's pretty sticky too.
Very, because it captures that essential duality. You need cunning and strength, brains and brawn. Knowing when to deploy each is the art of statecraft.
And maybe that idea often summarized as, the ends justify the means.
While he didn't say exactly those words, this quote captures the essence. The means will always be judged honorable and will be praised by everyone. His point is, if the ruler succeeds, creates a stable, prosperous state, people will ultimately approve of the methods used to get there, however harsh they seemed at the time. Success retroactively justifies the actions.
It's a challenging thought. Okay, these are 500-year-old ideas for Italian princes. How do they possibly apply to us today?
Surprisingly well in some areas. Think about, say, business and corporate leadership.
How so?
Well, the fox and lion thing. That's basically competitor analysis and strategic response, isn't it? Understand the threats. Fox have the resources and will to act lion. And change management sometimes, a swift, decisive restructuring, even if painful upfront, like Borgia's well-used cruelty, might be strategically better and ultimately less damaging to morale than long, drawn-out uncertainty and decline.
Okay, I can see that. What about on a more personal level, like navigating office politics?
Definitely. Understanding that people often act out of self-interest isn't cynical, it's just realistic. Recognizing that allows you to sort of anticipate moves, protect yourself, maybe not take things so personally. It becomes a defensive tool.
Like seeing the game being played.
Right. And the whole idea of virtue and fortuna, building those dikes against misfortune, that applies directly to career planning, financial planning, anticipate downturns, build skills, save money, prepare for the unpredictable. Don't just hope for good luck.
And bigger picture, international relations.
The prince is basically required reading for anyone studying political realism. The idea that nations act primarily out of self-interest, national security concerns, forming alliances based on pragmatism rather than shared ideology that's pure Machiavelli. Countries might cooperate with regimes they dislike to counter a bigger threat.
It seems depressingly accurate sometimes.
It often reflects reality, yeah.
Okay, wrapping this up, what's your final takeaway? What surprised you or stuck with you most from revisiting The Prince?
You know, what always strikes me again is that last chapter. Realizing his underlying motive wasn't just cynicism for its own sake. It was this deep, driving patriotism, this desire to see Italy unified and strong. The ruthless advice was, in his mind, for a noble cause. It complicates the picture beyond just evil Machiavelli.
Yeah, that's a really important context. For me, I think the biggest takeaway is just how unflinchingly it forces you to look at the mechanics of power, separate from intentions. It insists that good intentions are, frankly, useless without the skill, the virtue, the adaptability to actually achieve results in a messy world.
Effectiveness over intentions.
Exactly. Leadership involves these constant, uncomfortable tensions between what's ideal and what's necessary, what's good and what works. And Machiavelli gives you the unvarnished playbook for what works, whether you like it or not.
It definitely makes you think twice about how history remembers successful leaders, right? What might have happened behind the curtain?
Absolutely. A challenging read, but essential for understanding power. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.